Welcome to Introvable Chamber, a new series on this channel focusing on conceptual, principally Catholic history. And to begin this new series, I'm going to start off with a five-part saga on Dante. Today's episode, The Life of Dante Alighieri, the first of five narratives with Dante's works featuring front and centre. This first serving as an introduction both to Dante and to the Florence of the 13th and 14th centuries. Moreover, to the life as focusing on the new life, La Vita Nuova, his youth in Florence prior to his banishment. As for the works of Dante I intend to uncover on this series, principally it'll be La Vita Nuova, De Monarchia, and the Commedia, but also there'll be references to On the Eloquence of the Vernacular, The Banquet, Eclogues, The Flower, The Tale of Love, etc. And I want to start talking about Dante by referring to Carlyle on hero worship, referring to the hero as poet, and here I'm paraphrasing. Dante dwells apart in a kind of royal solitude, none equal, none to second in the general feeling of the world, a certain transcendentalism, a glory as of complete perfection invests Dante. He is canonized, though no pope or cardinals took a hand in doing it, such in spite of every perverting influence in the most unheroic times, is still our indestructible reverence for heroism, the hero as poet, as encapsulated in Dante. Carlyle here may be referring to his own secular canonization of Dante. However, he's not quite there when referring to no pope or cardinal taking a hand in doing it, not necessarily when it comes to sanctification, canonization, but certainly admiration. And again, this despite Dante's works having once been included on the index, because the index prohibited works. Because here I am reading from In Praeclara Summorum, an encyclical by Pope Benedict XV from 1921. Among the many celebrated geniuses, of whom the Catholic faith can boast, who have left undying fruits in literature and art especially, besides other fields of learning, and to whom civilization and religion are ever in debt, highest stands the name of Dante Alighieri. Wonderful is the intellectual enjoyment that we gain from the study of the great poet, and no less the profit for the student making more perfect his artistic taste and more keen his zeal for virtue. As long as he keeps his mind free from prejudice and open to accepted truth. Indeed, while there is no lack of great Catholic poets who combine the useful with the enjoyable, Dante has the singular merit that while he fascinates the reader with wonderful variety of pictures, with marvellously lifelike colouring, with supreme expression and thought, he draws him also to the love of Christian knowledge, and all know how he said openly that he composed his poem to bring about all vital nourishment by poem, referring to the Commedia, of course. And we know now to how, through God's grace, even in recent times, many who are far from, they're not averse to Jesus Christ, and studied with the affection the Divina Commedia, began by admiring the truths of the Catholic faith, and finished by throwing themselves with enthusiasm into the arms of the Church. Now, referring back to Carlyle, an unimportant, wandering, sorrow-stricken man, referring to Dante. Not much note was taken of him while he lived, and the most of that, the records of his life, have vanished in the long space that now intervenes. Carlyle writing in 1840. Carlyle then proceeds to quantify Dante, utilizing Giotto's iconic portrait as his poetic reference. His is the mournfulest face that ever was painted from reality. An altogether tragic, heart-affecting face. There is in it, as foundation of it, the softness, tenderness, gentle affection as of a child. But all this is as if congealed into sharp contradiction, into abnegation, isolation, proud, hopeless pain. A soft, ethereal soul looking out so stern, implacable, grim, trenchant, as for imprisonment of thick-ribbed ice. With all, it is a silent pain too, a silent, scornful one. The lip is curled in a kind of godlike disdain of the thing that is eating out his heart, as if it were withal a mean, insignificant thing, as if he whom it had power to torture and strangle were greater than it. The face of one wholly in protest and lifelong unsurrendering battle against the world, affection all converted into indignation, an implacable indignation, slow, equable, silent, like that of a god. The eye, too, it looks out as in a kind of surprise, a kind of inquiry, why the world was of such a sort. This is Dante, so he looks this voice of 10 silent centuries and sings us his mystic, unfathomable song. For the intense Dante is intense in all things. He has got into the essence of all, his intellectual insight as a painter, on occasion too as a reasoner, but it is the result of all other sorts of intensity, morally great above all, we must call him. It is the beginning of all, his scorn, his grief are as transcendent as his love. As for the specific aspects covering the life of Dante, Carlyle has already referred, writing in 1840, that very little has actually survived in terms of explicit references to the life of Dante. So I have an invaluable resource here, which is Elisa Brilli's and Giuliano Milani's Dante's New Lives, Biography and Autobiography, which was translated into English in 2023. As to summarize that, as Carlyle has already alluded to, scant materials focusing on the actual life of Dante. So the New Lives represents a very ambitious reconstruction, thanks in part to extrapolating details from the semi-biographical aspects of Dante's works. Such details and any sources that do exist are bracketed and invariably contradictory, tiles within a mosaic, hence the New Lives of Dante, a play on La Vita Nuova, the New Life. To begin, we're going to focus on the history of Florence, arriving at Dante's birth. Caccia Guida and the transformation of the city. And indeed, this painting is actually a useful reference in terms of trying to understand the anachronistic nature of trying to decipher any sort of biographical details about Dante, because D'Annunzio's famous painting, of course, is filled with such anachronisms, with, of course, the notorious Duomo in the background, which of course wasn't completed until around 150 years after Dante's death. And again, this is not just a feature of this painting, but you can say all pre-academic era paintings. When Dante was born in 1265, Florence was a city undergoing rapid growth. The 10,000 people who had lived there at the end of the 12th century had multiplied three or fourfold to reach the remarkable number of 60,000 around 1260. The figure would double again over the following half century. The rate of growth then slowed a little and came to an abrupt halt in 1348 when the Black Death carried off half the population. This demographic growth went hand in hand with urban expansion. The walls of the small Roman town, the footprint of which is still visible today in the rectangular stretching from the Via Tolomboni in the west to the Via del Proconsolo in the east, enclosed a little less than 20 hectares. Over the course of the 12th century, in the time of Caccia Guida, Dante's great-great-grandfather, suburbs began to develop around this rectangle. To protect them, the commune undertook the construction of a second set of fortifications around 1170, which reorientated the city around a northeast, somewhat southwest axis. However, by Dante's day, the earlier enterprise was only a distant memory compared to the works that took place in the 13th century, the time of his grandfather, Belencioni, and his father, Alighiero. Numerous suburbs grew up over the first half of the century, at the same time as the town on the left-hand bank of the river, known as the Otranto, developed to the point that the walls were extended to fortify it in 1258. In 1284, the government planned new city walls, which once completed in 1333, would enclose more than 400 hectares, more than 20 times the size of the city two centuries earlier. Let us enter into the Florence of Dante's great-great-grandfather, Caccia Guida, and centering a circle around the 400 foot in diameter on his small house, consider the environs in which it stood. The circle covered a large part of the northeastern quarter of the old Roman city, and was surrounded by the centres of power and money. To the north stood the cathedral and the baptistry. To the east, the area around the Golden Gate in the early medieval fortifications. To the south, where the Palazzo Vecchio currently stands, where there remains the Roman theatre, which, like other ancient ruins, provided building materials for the houses of the city's wealthiest inhabitants. Finally, to the west was the former Roman Cardo, today the Via Calimala, which crossed the city from the Bishop's Gate in the north to the Gate of St. Mary in the south, where it curves slightly to the west to meet the only bridge crossing the Arno in that period, the Ponte Vecchio. The most immediately striking detail about the inhabitants of the little area around 1150 is the almost complete absence of any of the important noble families who controlled the March of Tuscany, part of the then ancient Kingdom of Italy, which was in turn one of the kingdoms of the Holy Roman Empire. Indeed, Florentine society had undergone a major change at the beginning of the 12th century. The richest and most noble families, who had until then lived in the city, migrated en masse to their castles. The extinction of the Canossa dynasty, who had ruled the March of Tuscany, and the long absence of the German emperors from the Kingdom of Italy had created a power vacuum from which the aristocrats profited. They preferred the countryside, since it was easier to control. There, they seized the rights of knights, kings, margraves, and added the money gained therein, such as fines and taxes, to the rents produced by their lands. Other less powerful families remained in the city, and alongside the ecclesiastical and monastic authorities, would become the real protagonist of the first development of Florence. The most distant ancestor of Dante, whom the source permit us to identify, Cacciaguida, son of Adam, lived within the orbit of these important families. However, although he was a witness to a land grant made in 1131, in which individuals linked to the Badia and the Uberti families participated, no other document has survived to tell us whether or not he owned lands, and thereby give us an idea of his wealth and social status. Half a century later, in 1189, the sons of the deceased Cacciaguida, Prianito and Alighiero, the latter, the great-grandfather of Dante, who would give his name to the family and is always referred to with the Roman numeral 1 to distinguish him from his eponymous grandson, were implicated in a controversy with a priest from the Church of St. Martin. The affair initially seemed ridiculous. The two brothers eventually agreed to cut down a fig tree that was growing up the walls of the church. In reality, when we regard the case more closely, it seems that this proceeding was probably the first step, or the final step, rather, in a larger legal action conducted by the Church of St. Martin against those tenants who did not agree to its requests and did not pay their rents. This was, in any case, only a temporary victory for the priest, and more generally, far from it being a sign of economic trouble for Dante's ancestors, this document confirms their relatively powerful and prosperous condition. It is, above all else, a sign that ecclesiastical institutions were losing power to citizens, who from that point on exercised full control over the assets that the church had given to their ancestors. The rise of the Alighieri was shared by neighbouring families, alluded to decades later by Dante in the Commedia, the Donati, the Ademari, the Cavalcanti, Abati, and the Della Bella. By the beginning of the 13th century, these families possessed expansive dwellings, towers even, in Florence, a reflection of the city's urban transformation thanks to the move away from agriculture towards manufacturing, commerce, and finance. Alighiero is mentioned as part of a commercial agreement between Florence and the Republic of Venice, a glimpse into the economic and maritime transformation of Italy, spurred on by the rise of the maritime republics, including Genoa, and especially Pisa, with its close proximity to Florence. These republics had exploited opportunities afforded by the Crusades to import luxury goods from the Orient, yet also to increase exchanges with Northern Europe, specifically the importation of cloth. Florence soon became a textile manufacturer, while the increased economic activity necessitated the creation of notaries, judges, and lawyers. Given the absence now of a strong church, nobility, or even much of a local nobility within the confines of the city, a large elite strata comprised of the so-called urban militia, which far beyond a simple military clique, as the name would suggest, represented the society of merchants and the consulate of the Florence Commune, the closest thing resembling a government. With the presence of a governing elite representing around a seventh of Florence's population, conflicts between the noble families that remained flared up continuously. Dante would claim, through the Commedia, that his ancestor, Cacciaguida, was dubbed an imperial knight of the Emperor Conrad, accompanying the emperor on his crusade and to die there. However, there is no evidence that the Alighieri family were even part of the urban militia, at best as attested to by the family's wealth and Alighiero's part in a commercial treaty with Venice. The family were part of Florence's non-governing elite. This takes us to the conflict of the Guelphs and the Ghibellines, which to some loyal sort of viewers of the channel should already be very familiar with. This system of power relied on a series of compromises between the great families, compromises that were not destined to endure. And here again, I'm reading from Brilli. Tensions within the urban militia flared up again, inflamed by the wars that took place in the Italian peninsula and embittered by pressure from the lower levels of Florentine society, which was undergoing profound changes. The division of the Florentine elite into two factions, the Guelphs, representing the papacy, and the Ghibellines, representing the Hohenstaufens, and ultimately the imperial faction, as well as the entry onto the scene of a new group, the Popolo, the people, or the populace, whose members did not identify themselves as part of the tradition of this urban elite, decisively marked the second half of the 19th century in Florence. A well-known story, one which Dante would reflect deeply, traced the origins of the Florentine question back to a broken marriage promise. In 1216, a quarrel broke out during a banquet organized by Mazzino Mazzinghi to celebrate, and again, do forgive my Italian pronunciation, to celebrate his dubbing, the ceremony which conferred knighthood and consequently the inclusion into the Florentine elite. The feast degenerated into a brawl, and Bondelamonte ended up injuring Odo, the son of Origio Fifanti. To avoid a cycle of vengeance or vendetta, the families of the Fifanti clan, including the Uberti and their allies, decided that the aggressor would marry the niece of the victim. One of the Amidei, who possessed huge tracts of land, an agreement was reached. However, not long after, Gualrada, the wife of Forsi Donati, proposed to Bondelamonte that he marry her own daughter, and he gave her his word. Informed of the young man's betrayal, the members of the Fifanti Uberti clan got together and decided to kill him. From this grew the long feud between the group supporting the Bondelamonti and the Donati, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines led by the Uberti, the Amidei and the Fifanti. This legendary tale, which, like all mythological stories, simplifies the causes, has the benefit of directing attention towards two specific characteristics of the honor-obsessed Florentine knights: vengeance, which obliged clan members to exact retribution from members of the clan who had offended them, and marriage, which often sealed the truces and could temporarily interrupt periods of vendetta. Parallel to these modes of conflict resolution, there existed in Florence as elsewhere other more institutional methods of pacifying knights. Between 1210 and 1230, the old political system of consuls and one council gave way to a system of two councils, presided over by a foreign podesta. This magistrate, who held office for a year, was recruited from another city to ensure that he was well removed from the individual interest of the local factions. By disassociating the government of the city from direct contact with the competition between aristocratic families, the new political system contributed to the social advancement of citizens outside of noble circles, those who fought as foot soldiers in the army of the commune. These citizens also began to integrate into other institutions, ever more present in the political life of the period. The guilds, known as the Arti, the Association of Merchants, brought together long-distance traders and would soon take on the name of the Kalamala from the street just situated to the west of the parish of St. Martin, which was the heart of commercial activity in the city. The transition to the system of a foreign podesta in Florence had a second consequence for the city. Members of elite Florentine families were sent in their turn to become podestas elsewhere, which strengthened Florence's interregional influence, but also its participation in the armed conflicts throughout the Italian peninsulas, the wars of the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. In the same period, relations between the papacy and Emperor Frederick II, crowned in Rome in 1220, Emperor Frederick II, who ruled from Palermo in Sicily, after a long period of imperial interregnum, became strained. In 1236, war broke out and the city-states were forced to take sides. Support for one or the other redefined the many different internal conflicts between the groups of different knights and the popolo. Knights who opposed the emperor, like the Donati and the Bondelimonti, are referred to for the first time in the documents as the Guelphs, and their enemies, the Uberti and the Fifanti, as the Ghibellines. This conflict would mark the central decades of the 13th century, as the struggles between the papacy and Frederick II and his descendants intensified. 8 years later, Dante would identify this period as the beginning of the end of nobility and courtesy in Italy, as he would reference very subtly in the Purgatorio. When Dante was born in 1265, it was in a house situated at the centre of a web of ambitions. Those of his city, which over the last century had embarked upon the conquest of the region and of the European and Mediterranean markets, those of his ancient noble families who gathered together in their towers to make war on one another, those of other less wealthy families who were split between entering the nobility to take part in the factional disputes and devising alternative political systems to the culture of knighthood, those of his own family, which had hesitated between these two paths for several generations, finally those of his father, who had managed to survive three changes of regime during his adult life, and no doubt hoped that his son's future would be even brighter than his own. This was a rather heavy burden for a child who would make his first steps in a city that had once again been transformed, and this time even more radically. In the first 15 years of Dante's life, Florence went through four major transformations. The Ghibelline regime, under which he was born, was replaced by a popular regime in 1266, which gave way to a Guelph Angevin regime, Angevin referring to the Capetian branch of the House of Anjou under Charles Dominus, or later the King of Naples, in 1267. Before this too was fundamentally changed through the ascent of the Popolo, enabled by the weakening of the Guelph party from 1274 to 1275, and then by the 1280 peace with the Ghibellines. In spite of all these changes, one thing remained constant: the emergence of the non-elite members of the major guilds. Thanks to its intermediary position between the elite and the minor guilds, this social group won every time, independent of the political faction it happened to support. In many ways, the Alighieri family is a good example of this social group, oscillating between the urban militia with its factions and the popolo with its professional associations. The contributions of Alighiero, Dante's father, to the prosperity of his branch of the family are attested to, both by his wealth and his marriage policies, another form of investment. Alighiero married his children to his closest neighbours. One of his daughters married Leoni de Poggi, who lived in the same parish of St. Martin, and who, although he did not come from a wealthy family, became successful thanks to his political contacts. Certainly before 1281, and perhaps around 1275, another of his daughters, Tana, who was later known as Trota, married Lapa de Mano Ricomani, the son of a family of moneylenders in the parish of St. Martin, who were on the make in the second half of the 13th century. We know that the Alighieri provided a dowry of some 366 florins, a substantial sum, which they were ready to pay in order to establish a link with this powerful family. As for Dante himself, he married one Gemma di Meneto di Nati de Ebertino di Nati, also a resident of the parish of St. Martin. Although this marriage seemed to further the Alighieri's aspirations of strengthening their contacts and nobility, Meneto di Nati, Dante's father-in-law, came from a cadet branch of the family. In any case, the children of Dante and Gemma were born in the 1290s, three children, and it should be noted that this is in spite of the fact that from the age of nine, Dante would profess his undying love and affection to Beatrice Portinari, which is going to be the real substance of this presentation. He was married for most of this time. The matrimonial policy clearly places Alighiero and his children at the heart of a new social group that was imposing its hegemony on Florentine life. Though through marriage they linked themselves to families ranging from members of the popolo, well established in the institutions thanks to the continuing wars between the nobility, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines, to members of the major guilds, and even in Dante's case, to a minor branch of the ruling elite. So here I'm going to return briefly to the political situation in Florence before I get to the work of Dante himself. So just bear with me for a second. So this is around the 1280s. Dante is a teenager and he's sort of entering into his 20s. And a new political regime, following the upheaval of the previous decades, is coming to the fore. A new popular magistracy, which appeared in Florence, within which Dante himself would attain the zenith of his political career. Dubbed the Priorate of the Guilds, and formed of at first three, then six members, this new college sought to control the administration of public property, to guarantee the exercise of justice, and to protect internal peace, as well as the security of merchants faced with threats of the powerful. In fact, this magistracy became the Florentine institution that most closely resembled a government, and it was an organization in which the major guilds had the lion's share over the course of the first decades of the Priorate's existence. The guilds of the Calamala, the money changers, the wool merchants, the silk merchants, and the judges and the notaries clearly dominated the first 40% of the Priorate, and for most part, they were merchants, moneylenders, and judges who, minus some exceptions, had never been part of any consular elite. In the same years, Florence was increasing its authority over the whole of Tuscany, as the majority of traditional Ghibelline cities passed into the Guelph camp. In 1284, Genoa defeated Pisa at the Sea Battle of Meloria. Florence and Lucca not only profited from the latter's weakened state, but through a treaty in whose negotiation Brunetto Latini participated, succeeded in constraining Genoa's power. Furthermore, Florence managed to ensure that Pisa was governed by an autonomous Guelph regime directed by one Count Ugolino della Gelidezza. These Florentine intrigues will culminate in one of the earliest events in Dante's life from which we could formally attest, his participation alongside the Guelphs in the victorious Battle of Campaldino in 1289, whereafter Dante himself became involved in city politics through his membership of the Physicians and the Apothecaries Guild. Dante was substantially different to the rest of his political peers. Among them would comprise an organization known as the White Guelphs, which will be more relevant when I talk about Demonarchia in a future episode. A difference that would count for a lot when it came to the dramatic conclusion of his political engagement in the Florence Commune. He still did not have a real job in the government. Although he was on the side of Popolo and of the major guilds, Dante would neither become a notary, nor a judge, nor a spice merchant. He was what the ordinances referred to as a scio pelato, out of work, an inactive member of the guild, someone who, as the magnate Foresi Donati reproached him, didn't work. This negative specificity allows us to better understand the role played by this intense but ultimately brief political activity. It was preceded and interrupted by phases that allowed him to continue what had by this point been his principal activity for 20 years, namely writing poems. The civic engagement that Dante lived and observed in these years did not change his social status. However, it did become an essential part of his writing laboratory, with many consequences. Here I will leave Dante's political career and the events leading up to his exile from Florence. This subject will become more relevant later. For now, I want to turn to Dante's education and development as a poet, culminating in La Vita Nuova, The New Life. While the elite in the days of the consuls and the podestas had distinguished themselves through their skill in mounted combat, the new group to which Dante belonged was characterized above all by its relationship to writing. Mastery of the written word was essential for merchants, keeping their account books, all the more so in a market where the most transactions took place in credit. The lending of money always required a record to be left. The other members of the major guilds, doctors and apothecaries, some who traded in spices, and judges and notaries, were even more bound to the written word. The university faculty, that was preliminary to the studies in these areas, that of the artes, required the ability to read and write in Latin as a condition of entry. With the help of a passage from the famous Chronicle of Vivani, which was begun around 1320, it has been calculated that in 1338, between 67% and 90% of Florentine boys attended school. This percentage was most likely lower when Dante was a child in the 1270s, but it was nevertheless at this point that the process was made, Florence one of the most literate places in the pre-modern Europe. It is highly likely that in 1277, the presumed date of his marriage, Dante already read Latin, and this would have been the age of 12. At the time, Latin, which was simply called grammatica, the grammar par excellence, remained the medium through which reading was taught. The elementary cycle normally started around the age of 6 and finished around the age of 11. But these parameters were highly variable in Florence, where teachers of the young children were largely private. After this point, education divided into two streams. Some pursued the study of Latin in the proper grammatica schools in order to prepare themselves for careers as notaries, judges, or churchmen. Others entered into the abaco schools from Leonardo Fibonacci's Liber Abaci, where they learnt calculations, geometry, and arithmetic to become merchants or engineers. It was during the second phase of study that children really began to learn to write. This separation between reading and writing might seem surprising today, but it was characteristic of pre-modern societies. Even though we do not know how or where Dante pursued his studies, judging by the texts he wrote around the age of 30, his command of Latin is such that it would be hard to believe that this came from a late period of formation, his language. It is therefore highly likely that he attended a proper grammatical school during his adolescence. The core readings for this course of study began with the Distichia Catonis, a collection of around 50 brief maxims and 100 or so moralizing proverbs attributed to Cato. Next, pupils advanced to longer and more complex poetic works. Other texts, then more complicated, and then completed this ensemble, the Elegia, or the Eligio di Settimello, a poem written by 12th century Florentines, which laments the changeability of fortune and praises the strength of moral philosophy, or its model, Boethius's The Consolations of Philosophy, which played a fundamental role in Dante's reflections. This list shows the extent to which the learning of Latin consisted not just of acquiring another language, but of obtaining moral edification. In continuity with the long church tradition, the works and authors studied in school were all presented as sources of wisdom. It was only once this moral apprenticeship had been completed that the students arrived at the Auctoris Maiores, Virgil, Ovid, Statius, who were then read in order to unfold their hidden lessons. Dante's mastery over Latin wouldn't necessarily indicate the transformative effect of his writings on the Tuscan vernacular and later Italian language, though see Dante's essay on the eloquence in the vernacular. In Florence, as in other Italian cities, the advent of new social groups produced a demand for new texts, models of speeches and letters, synthesis of the arts, decamatus, and manuals of rhetoric became indispensable instruments for living in a society and debating in public. Yet Florence distinguished itself from other cities in that the response to the demand was made in vernacular texts that were accessible to those who did not know Latin or who knew it properly or who did not know it properly. This phenomenon profoundly marked the culture of the city and its most famous citizen, Dante. Dante's friend, mentor, and later guardian, Brunetto Latini, who I mentioned previously as being involved in a political scheme, an integral part of the Guelph administration in Florence, whom Dante would later encounter in the Commedia along the Sodomites, though many scholars question whether Dante was fair in consigning Latini to the Inferno, represents for Dante an awkward literary halfway house. Despite Latini being of Tuscan nobility, as a representative of Charles of Anjou, the Angevin Dominus in Italy, he worked and wrote in French. It is in French that he composed the Trésor, his encyclopedic book of treasures. However, this proliferation of the French literary vernacular presaged Dante's own revolution with the Italian language, though according to Dante himself, poets began writing in the vernacular to win the hearts of ladies who didn't understand Latin. In his youth, Dante was exposed to the poets in the Tuscan Italian vernacular more generally, Guido Guarnizelli of Bologna, and the Ghibelline Sicilian school, which of course wouldn't have been of the Tuscan vernacular, but nevertheless was a significant source of Italian poetry. And this, of course, was all associated and emanating out of the imperial court of Frederick II in Palermo during the first half of the 13th century. Guarnizelli himself expounded that love is not a heresy that separates humanity from God, but the most obvious sign of a noble heart, and indication of perfect individual virtue, and a mark of belonging to an elite group of virtuous men. His other influence came from the troubadours of Occitania and the Provençal poet Dante de Miano, who replied to Dante's sonnet, "To Every Captive Soul," which I'm going to reference towards the end. Then, of course, the Latin writers, Cicero and Virgil, who would escort Virgil especially, who would escort Dante through the Inferno, and for which Dante would owe the inspiration for the eclogues. Thereafter, Dante studied philosophy at the Dominican school, Santa Maria Novella. This education in part explains why he desired to join the Physicians Guild in 1295, which, as I mentioned, was a part of his political formation, albeit he would still be derided as one who was out of work. Now, finally, we get to Dante and Beatrice, and I'll be reading segments from La Vita Nuova, though just a reference, I'm reading from the D.G. Rossetti translation. This is also a painting by D.G. Rossetti, because in addition to being a Dante enthusiast, he was a translator, a writer, and a painter. In fact, he was the founder of the Pre-Raphaelite movement. This is from the beginning of La Vita Nuova. 9 times already since my birth had the heaven of light returned to the selfsame point, almost as concerns its own revolution, when first the glorious lady of my mind was made manifest to mine eyes. Even she who was called Beatrice by many who knew not wherefore, she had already been in this life for so long as that within her time the starry heaven had moved towards the eastern quarter, one of the 12 parts of a degree, so that she appeared to me at the beginning of her 9th year almost, and I saw her almost at the end of my 9th year. Her dress on that day was of a most noble colour, a subdued and goodly crimson, girdled and adorned in such sort as best suited with her very tender age. At that moment I say most truly that the spirit of life, which hath its dwelling in the secretest chamber of the heart, began to tremble so violently that the least pulses of my body shook therewith. And in trembling it said these words, Ecce Deus fortea me, qui veniens dominabito mihi. Behold, a God stronger than I, who coming shall rule over me. At that moment, the animate spirit which dwelleth in the lofty chamber, whither all the senses carried their perceptions, was filled with wonder, and speaking more especially unto the spirits of the eyes, said these words, Apparuit iam beatudo vestra. Now has appeared your bliss. At that moment, the natural spirit which dwelleth there, where our nourishment is administered, began to weep, and in weeping said these words, Quia misa, quia frequenta impeditus elo dinceps. Woe is me, wretched, because often from this time forth I shall be hindered. I say that from that time forward, love quite governed my soul, which was immediately espoused to him, and with so safe and undisputed lordship by virtue of strong imagination, that I had nothing left for it but to do all his bidding. The new life could be said to be an autobiography, taken to be the life of Dante. However, it is autobiography as transcendent to the realms of poetic truth. When it is debatable at that time whether autobiography as a distinctive genre of literature even existed. Biography so transposed as with Schiller and the nascent discipline of history centuries later, linking this back to the beginning, to Schiller's Scottish disciple, Thomas Carlyle, who wrote in the same vein. As for Beatrice Portinari, of which essentially would be the recurring motif, person, to which love is essentially the representative of, the epitome of, she died in 1290, 4 years prior to the construction of La Vita Nuova. Indeed, her character, I would perhaps say unfortunately, has been subject to the same radical revisionism as has William Shakespeare and his authorship of his plays, with some claiming that the poetic Beatrice is in fact a synthesis of Dante's romantic attachments towards various women, no doubt a romantic deconstruction that removes all of the poetic vitality from Dante's works. Of course, this will take in my entire life, or possibly the entire life, to disprove that, and it will never be proven one way or the other, like William Shakespeare's apparently dubious authorship of his own plays, which hasn't really been proven, especially if you listen to Nima Parvini. And I'm referring here back to Brealey, and this is a note referring to the construction, the history of the construction of the La Vita Nuova. Between 1283 and the composition of the Vita Nuova, just over a decade later, Dante wrote at least 60 or so poems, 58 of which have come down to us. These consist of the 31 poems later collected in the Vita Nuova, 13 of which also circulated in slightly different versions that are considered earlier drafts, as well as 27 others not included in the Vita, which have consequently been dubbed the Estravaganti by researchers. To these, we must add the poems Dante mentions having written, but of which we have no trace, and perhaps the Fiore or the Detto d'Amore. However, the uncertain chronology and conventions of the medieval lyric and the absence of a coherent life writing project make it difficult to use these poems to reconstruct either Dante's life or the stories created around it. Starting with the chronological difficulties, in Michel Barbi's edition, long the standard reference for the poems, are divided into those that appear in the Vita Nuova and those that do not. The second group is then organized into a purportedly chronological order based on the thematic and stylistic criteria. There have been many attempts to refine the order, but the general approach persists, even in the editions by Domenico De Robertis. This traditional chronology begins at first with the Guettonian phase, in which Dante followed the footsteps of the previous generation of poets and its leader, Guettoni d'Arezzo, whom Dante would later sharply critique. It then underlines the turning point formed by Dante's discovery of Guido Ginizelli, and especially by his friendship with Guido Cavalcanti, men whom Dante would later hail as the greatest of poets, after himself, of course. Finally, it identifies the creation of a new poetic school by Dante, Cavalcanti, and other Florentines, which he would later term the New School. This reconstruction extends backwards in time, the periodizations and categories of Italian vernacular literature that Dante would develop years later in the De Vulgari Eloquenta on the uses of the vernacular, and the Commedia, a literary history that promotes a teleological vision in which he himself was the end goal. So on the one hand, we talk about Dante's poetic narcissism and the pitiable creature he presents himself in his love poems. However, it is not always easy to situate each poem within the schema. Only three or perhaps four are datable. The rest of the poems are dated on the basis of their stylistic qualities, which is to say, according to the schema that has just been described. They cannot therefore be seen as proof for the validity of this schema. Moreover, as stylistic qualities are by their nature variable, different scholars might attach the same poem to various periods. Above all, we know precious little about Dante's actual composition process. The chronological succession of styles, therefore, remains a petito principi, and stylistic diversity between these texts does not necessarily indicate their temporal separation in time. All we can say for certain is that between the ages of 18 and 30, Dante practiced and experimented with poetry, while the remaining within a fairly narrow field. He wrote exclusively vernacular lyric poetry, a traditional metrical forms, but contrary to the preceding generations, there was only one subject for Dante and his peers, and that subject was love. The principal theme of Dante's work was love. There is nothing surprising in this, except perhaps in that the young poet made it his only subject for his verses. Furthermore, Dante made it the theme to which all others were subordinated. With the exception of politics, which was completely absent from the preoccupations of his generation who had grown up thriving, but generally in peaceful Florence of the 1280s, a brief moment of peace in the great storm of the Guelph and Ghibelline complex, the Eye of the Storm, rather. We therefore see Dante explore and adapt the repertoire of two centuries of vernacular lyric tradition. The type of love song, known as l'élan, for example, celebrates the feelings inspired by a separation from the lady. In Lo mia servente core, love gave to you, we find the topos of the heart left to the lady according to the feudal custom, which reappears in the canzoni la disperata mente ci pormira, pitiless memory, still gazing back, and the sonnet, love let's set aside some time to talk, and the ballad, my ballad, I request you to seek out love, belongs instead to a new genre in which the poet begs forgiveness for a fault committed, often attentions paid to another lady. Managing multiple loves is indeed a major preoccupation. In the lyric tradition, the transition from one love to another gave rise to a specific subgenre, the change song. Dante made two passes at this. In the sonnet, while riding down the road the other day, love himself incites the protagonist to devote his heart to a new lady. In another sonnet, all the charms of Lisetto or Licenza are not enough to make the poet concede. Here the theme of the change is taken up, but aborted. In the same spirit, a group of poems written a little later explore an unusual variant on the genre, the possibility of a love founded not on pleasure, but on shared pain, and the problem of fidelity beyond death. It is precisely here, at the intersection of love and death, that Dante produced his most original poetry. He considered love from every angle. Its positive, even salvific, effects are the subject of his best-known poems. From My Lady Show Such Grace and Dignity, but its negative sides are also explored. We therefore find lamentations on love lost developed in O You Who Walk Along the Path of Love, the spiritual cacophony which the combat of feelings produces, as in All My Thoughts, and even invocations to death, the only way out of the sufferings of love. Now, I think it would be instructive for all of us to read out a brief summary of La Vita Nuova, which again, this is coming from Brilli. At first sight, the Vita Nuova is the story of a lover enchanted with a young girl called Beatrice, even by those who did not know what her name was. This quote is taken from the chapter in which Dante described their first meeting, age 9, and it reveals that there is a dual significance in the events described in the story. The meaning of the name Beatrice, literally she who gives beatitude, is here revealing by the reaction of the animal spirit, one of the personifications through which Dante expresses his internal life. At the sight of the young girl, it exclaims, "Now your bliss has appeared." The name, therefore, as the prose highlights, gives access to the real nature of things. This observation holds true for all the chronological details, especially the ages of the protagonists, even if the mystery of the figure of nine is only revealed later on. While this first meeting is depicted as a perfect example of the courtly theory of love at first sight, it also immediately takes on a supernatural aura. The first verb referring to Beatrice is, significantly, appeared, apparition, and Dante repeats this same verb 5 times in this chapter alone, giving this sense a visionary quality that recalls the aura of his adolescent poems. Moreover, this moment also marks the beginning of the mystic marriage of the lover to love, who henceforth becomes his lord. Anticipating possible criticisms, Dante specifies that the subservience was never without the faithful counsel of reason. It is that, therefore, a passionate and irrational love, like that theorized by Cavalcanti. These few lines immediately affirm, if this is a question of love, it is love like no other. The narrator of the Vita Nuova then spends the rest of the story retracting his steps to learn how to properly enjoy the beatitude dispensed by this Beatrice, who is so different from the other ladies of other poets, as well as from the lady Dante formerly desired and called by this name, the real Beatrice. This journey only begins at the age of 18. With the sonnet, A Chiasm Alma, this sonnet's position in the Vita Nuova merits as much attention as do the details added by the prose. Beginning a life writing exercise with an allegorical dream with nothing new, it is a strategy that the Vita Nuova shares with the Roman de la Rose. As Michael Zink has observed, the opening dream in this poem gave the meaning of those events in advance of their occurrence in the narrative events, which are later explained thanks to the writing out of the dream, which was in every sense a term or reflection of the dream. The parallel allows us to better understand why, in Vita Nuova, that this sonnet, formerly a puzzle, has become charged with a mysterious meaning that, according to the author, escaped all his fellow poets. Dante here reuses the sonnet to signal the initiatory nature of the lover's journey. The initiation includes all of the elements usually found in the love story of the later Middle Ages, but only in order to set them aside one by one to a pitiless logic. The first to be subject to this logic are the courtly norms, the servitum amoris, and namely the dissimulation of the lover's feelings in order to protect the honour of the lady. Dante recounts having cultivated for years false feelings for another woman as a screen for his true love. This move serves a dual purpose, as it also justifies the existence of poems addressed to women other than Beatrice, of which his readers would no doubt be aware. After the departure of this woman, love provides a new screen lady for the lover. However, this strategy was doomed to failure. According to Dante, Beatrice did not appreciate the rumours about this affair and expressed this by refusing to even greet the lover. I think it's rather appropriate to have Henry Holliday's painting here to illustrate that fact. This gives the poet the opportunity for a digression, demonstrating that in her salutation dwelt my bliss. In this type of situation, courtly tradition advises a recourse to the escondic, an excuse poem designed to appease the jealous lady. The lover decides on the solution during a dream in which he has a heart-to-heart with love. The ballato, Ivo Citu, a personified poem, follows up on love's suggestion not to address himself directly to the lady. Yet all these precautions are of no use. The lady's continuing indifference sets off a debate within the lover, like those that Dante would have seen play out in the studia of the mendicant orders. The goodness of love, which ends with the conclusion from now on evident that the lady through whom love makes you suffer, so is not like the other ladies. However, the lowest point has not yet been reached. The next victim of the Vita Nuova is the lover himself, notably in the episode of the trick. He finds himself so troubled, even transfigured, when he meets the lady at a wedding, that Beatrice's friends mock him. The only way out is to flee and write poems now directly addressed to the lady to make her share in his pitiable state. When this route proves no more effective than the last, the lover experiences a radical aphasia, a symbolic death. It is precisely at this point that the story marks a turning point. Dante underlines it with care. After the composition of these sonnets, he believed, "I should be silent and say no more about this. I felt forced to find a new theme, one nobler than the last. The new theme and the circumstances of its discovery are the subject of the following pages, which recount how the lover was questioned by the ladies who have intellect of love, whom we already know. These ladies do not, however, manage to understand the point of a hopeless love, and so decide that he must have an aim which is strange indeed. The lover then explains to them that since she has denied him her greeting, the only way to enjoy the beatitude that Beatrice gives is for him to continue to sing her praises, his pleasure residing in those words that praise my lady. The canzone Donna ci avete intelletto d'amore, whose opening words form on the lover's lips as if by enchantment, is the first manifestation of this new awareness. We might expect this discovery to be the end of the Vita Nuova, the history of the story of the lover who would end with the triumph of the disinterested love and the poems that celebrate it, doubtless the best known of these by the young Dante. However, as we have said, the logic of this love, like no other, is pitiless. The lover is saved, but another victim is sacrificed instead, Beatrice. The death of the beloved lady is foreshadowed many times before it becomes reality. It appears first in elliptical references, such as the dream of death of the woman, whom the prose alone identifies as Beatrice's friend. The premonitions then intensify. Dante juxtaposes the memory of the death of Beatrice's father with that of his illness. This accelerating rhythm, cut short by the first verse of the canzone Si Lungiamenti, a poem left unfinished, also the prose tells us, because of the arrival of the news of the death of Beatrice. It has been suggested that this canzone was never intended to have more than one stanza, as is the case for Dante's other adolescent poems, and that it is presented here as unfinished in order to better underline the narrative rupture caused by Beatrice's death. It is still worth emphasizing that this canzone sums up the long process of the lover's development, from his arduous beginnings to his current refinement, and that this summary comes at a particularly appropriate moment. It both dramatizes the death of the lady and pushes back the discovery of a disinterested love to the period before this event. What I find fascinating in terms of trying to understand this within the realms of Catholic conceptual history, situating this within not just the political, but also the intellectual context of Venice at the time, sorry, of Florence at the time, and trying to understand his motifs, biblical motifs. Obviously, these are more evident in the Commedia, which has other references, but I really want to focus here on this idea of the relationship between Beatrice, the veneration of Mary, and indeed deep Christian themes relating to Annunciation, Theophany, love, and all of these other elements, just to conclude this. And this is the final segment I'm going to be reading by Brilli, which I think is really fundamental in terms of trying to understand the links and the allusions to theology in Dante. Turning back to the rise of religious and scriptural themes, as we have observed in considering Dante's earlier poems, the hybridity of the language of earthly and heavenly love was not a new phenomenon in medieval literature. Dante merely practiced it with an unmatched intensity. The praise of the miracle that is Beatrice, the funerary theme, and more generally, the Lamentiato, which contains the majority of the poet's lover's public speeches and overtly links him to the prophet Jeremiah. The vision of the afterlife, on which the story ends, all these are motives from the Christian discursive universe that would have been very familiar to the then lay Florentine audience to which Peter John Olivi had addressed some years before his commentary on the Lamentations. These religious themes are not only there to sacralize the love for the lady, to the extent that they approximate the servitum amoris, the servitude to love, or the submission to love, and the poetry that springs from it to a sort of priesthood modeled on Christian sacerdotal and liturgical practices. They ensure the legitimacy and visibility of poetry in public space, the development of spiritualizing love that endures beyond life and death, the subject of the lover's story, and surpassing of all previous vernacular poetry, the subject of the poet's story, are both foundations for the third journey through which the poet-lover becomes someone whose words are received in public. Referring back to this aspect of modelled on the Christian sacerdotal and liturgical practices, in the same way that the priest in Catholicism undergoes and sort of submits himself to a process of celibacy, chastity, in order to focus one's entire life in the celebration and worship of God. Indeed, when one is talking about the lover, whose love is entirely founded on reason, the love of a woman who is unlike any other, of course, such love cannot necessarily be carnal, especially when it's unrequited and pitiless in the case of Beatrice. So this in many ways represents another sacerdotal aspect of Christian worship. It represents another form of chastity within this whole grand schema of Christianity. As far as one can draw Beatrice to Mary, obviously we're talking about instead the love of the mother, essentially, as into almost like the annunciation between God and essentially the receiving of Christ. Dante's benediction of love, you can almost say, approaches the threshold of Ave Beatrix gratia plena, Hail Beatrice full of grace, however, without finally crossing this threshold into blasphemy, as representing all of love sublimated to a woman. Indeed, if we're going back to allusions to Virgil, of course, and Caesar, who is the source of the essentially the divine power, it is Venus Genetrix. So again, there are perhaps some themes of antiquity feeding into this veneration of the specific aspect of the worship of love, especially given the veneration of Dante towards Virgil. Indeed, if we're looking back to this aspect of theophany, apparition, the appearance of love as the appearance of God, I want to take us back to La Vita Nuova, and specifically betaking me to the loneliness of mine own room, I fell to thinking of this most courteous lady, thinking of whom I was overtaken by a pleasant slumber, wherein a marvellous vision was presented to me. For there appeared to be in my room a mist of the colour of fire, within which I discerned the figure of a lord, terrible aspect to such as should gaze upon him, but who seemed therewithal to rejoice inwardly, that it was a marvel to see. Speaking, he said many things, among the which I can understand but few, and of these this, Ego Dominus Tuus, I am thy Lord. In his arms it seemed to me that a person was sleeping, covered only with a blood-coloured cloth, the Catholic colour of the Passion, upon whom, lookingly very attentively, I knew that it was the lady of the salutation, Beatrice, who had deigned the day before to salute me. And he held her so in his hand, a thing that was burning in flames, and he said to me, Vide cor tuum, behold my heart. This particular segment is actually taken from The New Life, is actually a variation on one of Dante's earliest attributed sonnets, To Every Captive Soul, from 1283. And indeed, as you can see here, the Immaculate Heart of Mary on the left, surrounded in fire. Obviously, the motif is obvious here, albeit Mary has become the singular object of a chaste form of love founded on reason, essentially a love which is transcendent and poetic as opposed to carnal. Indeed, if we're referring back to the various sins which Dante is well aware of and is going to describe in the Commedia coming next. I just on another note, I will also point out that vide cor tuum, vide cor meum, to every captive soul. It's very obvious that Hans Zimmer was very much inspired by this, by Dante when composing, I think it was the score for Hannibal. And I'll probably note that it's by far his best music, and everything since has become horribly cliche, but that's just a note to bring this entire conversation down for a second. So focusing on the heart, the Immaculate Heart, and again, it has to be immaculate in the sense because the love itself is chaste. It is not the desire of carnal passions. I just want to, this final segment from really. The pivot of the vision is Dante's heart, which nourishes the central enigma. The giving of the heart as a food offering to the beloved winks at a well-established medieval literary motif, widely known as the Eden heart. In the French and Occitan versions that were most likely available to Dante, the schema unfolds as follows. An adulterous couple is discovered. The cuckolded husband kills his wife's lover, who is usually a poet, rips out his heart, and then has it cooked and served to the lady. In some versions, other organs, especially the genitals, are also involved. She eats the grisly meal without trouble, but, upon being told the truth, dies as well, either of sorrow or by suicide. This motif is inherently ambiguous. Its meaning changes depending on whose perspective we see it from. It symbolizes vengeance, who force their unfaithful wives to become monstrous cannibals, but a sublimation of the finality of love for the lovers. However, what Dante does, you can say, is take this rather grotesque motif from earlier poetry and completely juxtaposes it in terms of the sublime, because now the lover's body, the body of the woman, is becoming a reliquary for the heart through a process of physical absorption, not dissimilar that to a Eucharistic rite. So you can say that from the cannibalistic imagery that Dante receives, he then transforms it into the transubstantiation. And of course, for people who don't believe in the transubstantiation, the boundary between cannibalism and, you can say, the reception of the nourishment essentially afforded by the real presence is completely lost. But obviously, Dante had to be aware of that in order to take such imagery and completely turn it on its head. I'll conclude this episode, mainly focusing on La Vita Nuova, with this sonnet, All Ye That Pass Along Love's Trodden Way. Here, Dante is brought to the extreme abject humility, the poor, wretched sinner in the pursuit, you can almost say, of the wealth of the kingdom of heaven as embodied in his virtuous love. Indeed, I see echoes of Matthew 13, the parable of the pearl. But to refer back again to Guinizelli, love is not a heresy that separates humanity from God, but the most obvious sign of a noble heart and indication of perfect individual virtue. Yet, of course, this is juxtaposed by Dante's shame to be cast out from Eden to endure spiritual agony. And indeed, in terms of the unrequited nature of this love towards Beatrice, love here is not a love of God. It is not a love given. It is a love denied. So whereas God essentially is omnibenevolent, in the case of this unrequited love, it is a state of supreme pitilessness. All ye that pass along love's trodden way, pause ye a while and say, if there be any grief like unto mine, I pray that you hearken a short space. Patiently, if my case be not a piteous marvel and a sign, love never certainly for my worthless part, but of his own great heart, vouchsafe to me a life so calm and sweet, that oft I heard folk question as I went, what such great gladness meant. They spoke of it behind me in the street, but now that fearless bearing is all gone, which with love's hoarded wealth was given me, till I am grown to be so poor that I have dread to think thereon. And thus it is that I, being like as one who is ashamed and hides his poverty, without seem full of glee, and let my heart within travail and moan. Thank you very much. I'm just going to quickly get through the super chats and call it a night. Ipsy from Jaden for $10. Thank you. Ipsy Gloria et Imperium in Secalum Secalorum. Amen. Well, thank you very much, Jaden, for that. And thank you very much for everything. And it's wonderful to see you all back. Judge Caligula Bushman just sends €3. Thank you very much. And Max, far from me to mock your Italian pronunciation, Mr. A. Well, unfortunately, when it comes to comments, most people do tend to focus on my mispronunciation. So there we are. All right. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope to see you all again soon with more Dante.